In such cases, each person seems usually to have a system of symbology of his own. Mrs. Crowe mentions, in her Night Side of Nature, p.54, a lady who, whenever a misfortune was impending, dreamt that she saw a large fish. One night she dreamt that this fish had bitten two of her little boy's fingers. Immediately afterwards, a schoolfellow of the child's injured those two very fingers by striking him with a hatchet. I have met with several persons who have learned by experience to consider one particular dream as a certain prognostic of misfortune. There are, however, a few points upon which most of these dreamers agree, as, for example, that to dream of deep waters signifies approaching trouble, and that pearls are a sign of tears. The factors in the production of dreams. Having thus examined the condition of man during sleep, we see that the factors which may be concerned in the production of dreams are, 1. The ego, who may be in any state of consciousness from almost utter insensibility to perfect command of his faculties, and as he approximates to the latter condition, enters more and more fully into possession of certain powers transcending any that most of us possess in our ordinary waking state. 2. The astral body, ever palpitating with the wild surgings of emotion and desire. 3. The etheric part of the brain, with a ceaseless procession of disconnected pictures sweeping through it. 4. The lower physical brain, with its infantile semi-consciousness and its habit of expressing every stimulus in pictorial form. When we go to sleep, our ego withdraws further within himself, and leaves his various encasements freer to go their own way than they usually are. But it must be remembered that the separate consciousness of these vehicles, when they are thus allowed to show it, is of a very rudimentary character. When we add that each of these factors is then infinitely more susceptible of impression from without even than it ordinarily is, we shall see small cause to wonder that the recollection on waking, which is a sort of synthesis of all the different activities which have been going on, should generally be somewhat confused. Let us now, with these thoughts in our minds, see how the different kinds of dreams usually experienced are to be accounted for. Chapter 5, Dreams. The True Vision. This, which cannot properly be classified as a dream at all, is a case where the ego either sees for himself some fact upon a higher plane of nature, or else has it impressed upon him by a more advanced entity. At any rate, he is made aware of some fact which it is important for him to know, or perhaps sees some glorious and ennobling vision which encourages and strengthens him. Happy is the man to whom such vision comes with sufficient clearness to make its way through all obstacles and fix itself firmly in his waking memory. The prophetic dream. This also we must attribute exclusively to the action of the ego, who either foresees for himself or is told of some future event for which he wishes to prepare his lower consciousness. This may be of any degree of clearness and accuracy, according to the power of the ego to assimilate it himself and, having done so, to impress it upon his waking brain. Sometimes the event is one of serious moment, such as death or disaster, so that the motive of the ego in endeavoring to impress it is obvious. On other occasions, however, the fact foretold is apparently unimportant, and it is difficult for us to comprehend why the ego should take any trouble about it. Of course, it is always possible that in such a case the fact remembered may be only a trifling detail of some far larger vision, the rest of which has not come through to the physical brain. Often the prophecy is evidently intended as a warning, and instances are not wanting in which that warning has been taken, and so the dreamer has been saved from injury or death. In most cases the hint is neglected, or its true signification not understood until the fulfillment comes. In others an attempt is made to act upon the suggestion, but nevertheless circumstances over which the dreamer has no control bring him in spite of himself into the position foretold. Stories of such prophetic dreams are so common that the reader may easily find some in almost any of the books on such subjects. I quote a recent example from Mr. W. T. Stead's Real Ghost Stories, p. 77. The hero of the tale was a blacksmith at a manufacturing mill, which was driven by a water wheel. He knew the wheel to be out of repair, and one night he dreamed that at the close of the next day's work the manager detained him to repair it, that his foot slipped and became entangled between the two wheels, and was injured and afterwards amputated. He told his wife the dream in the morning, and made up his mind to be out of the way that evening if he was wanted to repair the wheel. During the day the manager announced that the wheel must be repaired when the work people left that evening, but the blacksmith determined to make himself scarce before the hour arrived. He fled to a wood in the vicinity, and thought to hide himself there in its recesses. He came to a spot where lay some timber which belonged to the mill, and detected a lad stealing some pieces of wood from the heap. On this he pursued him in order to rescue the stolen property, and became so excited that he forgot all about his resolution, and ere he was aware of it, found himself back at the mill just as the workmen were being dismissed. He could not escape notice, and as he was principal smith he had to go upon the wheel, but he resolved to be unusually careful. In spite of all his care, however, his foot slipped and got entangled between the two wheels, just as he had dreamed. It was crushed so badly that he had to be carried to the Bradford Infirmary, where the leg was amputated above the knee, so the prophetic dream was fulfilled throughout. The symbolical dream. This, too, is the work of the ego, and, indeed, it might almost be defined as a less successful variant of the preceding class, for it is, after all, an imperfectly translated effort on his part to convey information as to the future. A good example of this kind of dream was described by Sir Noel Paton in a letter to Mrs. Crowe, published by the latter in The Night Side of Nature. The great artist writes, "That dream of my mother's was as follows. She stood in a long, dark, empty gallery. On one side was my father, on the other my eldest sister, then myself and the rest of the family according to their ages. We all stood silent and motionless. At last it entered, the unimagined something that, casting its grim shadow before, HD enveloped all the trivialities of the preceding dream in the stifling atmosphere of terror. It entered, stealthily descending the three steps that led from the entrance down into the chamber of horror, and my mother felt that it was death. He carried on his shoulder a heavy axe, and had come, she thought, to destroy all her little ones at one fell swoop. On the entrance of the shape my sister Alexis leapt out of the rank, interposing herself between him and my mother. He raised his axe and aimed a blow at my sister Catherine, a blow which, to her horror, my mother could not intercept, though she had snatched up a three-legged stool for that purpose. She could not, she felt, fling the stool at the figure without destroying Alexis, who kept shooting out and in between her and the ghastly thing. Down came the axe, and poor Catherine fell. Again the axe was lifted by the inexorable shape over the head of my brother, who stood next in the line, but now Alexis had disappeared somewhere behind the ghastly visitant, and with a scream my mother flung the stool at his head. He vanished and she awoke. 3 months had elapsed when we children were all of us seized with scarlet fever. My sister Catherine died almost immediately, sacrificed, as my mother in her misery thought, to her, my mother's, over anxiety for Alexis, whose danger seemed more imminent. The dream prophecy was in part fulfilled. I also was at death's door, given up by the doctors, but not by my mother. She was confident of my recovery. But for my brother, who was scarcely considered in danger at all, but over whose head she had seen the visionary axe impending, her fears were great, for she could not recollect whether the blow had or had not descended when the spectre vanished. My brother recovered, but relapsed and barely escaped with life, but Alexis did not. For 1 year and 10 months the poor child lingered, and I held her little hand as she died. Thus the dream was fulfilled. It is very curious to notice here how accurately the details of the symbolism work themselves out, even to the supposed sacrifice of Catherine for the sake of Alexis, and the difference in the manner of their deaths. For, the vivid and connected dream, this is sometimes a remembrance, more or less accurate, of a real astral experience which has occurred to the ego while wandering away from his sleeping physical body. More frequently, perhaps, it is the dramatization by that ego either of the impression produced by some trifling physical sound or touch, or of some casual idea which happens to strike him. Examples of this latter kind have already been given, and there are many to be found of the former also. We may take as an instance an anecdote quoted by Mr. Andrew Lang, in Dreams and Ghosts, from the distinguished French physician Dr. Brière de Borchemont, who describes it as occurring within his own intimate knowledge. Miss C., a lady of excellent sense, lived before her marriage in the house of her uncle D., a celebrated physician and member of the Institute. Her mother at this time was seriously ill in the country. One night the girl dreamed that she saw her mother, pale and dying, and especially grieved at the absence of two of her children, one a cure in Spain, and the other, herself, in Paris. Next she heard her own Christian name called, Charlotte. And in her dream saw the people about her mother bring in her own little niece and godchild Charlotte from the next room. The patient intimated by a sign that she did not want this Charlotte, but her daughter in Paris. She displayed the deepest regret, her countenance changed, she fell back and died. Next day the melancholy of Miss C. attracted the attention of her uncle. She told him her dream, and he admitted that her mother was dead. Some months later, when her uncle was absent, she arranged his papers, which he did not like anyone to touch. Among these was a letter containing the story of her mother's death and giving all the details of her own dream, which D. had kept concealed lest they should impress her too painfully. Sometimes the clairvoyant dream refers to a matter of much less importance than a death, as in the following case, which is given by Drive F. G. Lee in Glimpses in the Twilight, p. 108. A mother dreams that she sees her son on a boat of strange shape, standing at the foot of a ladder which leads to an upper deck. He looks extremely pale and warm, and says to her earnestly, "Mother, I have nowhere to sleep." In due course a letter arrives from the son, in which he encloses a sketch of the curious boat, showing the ladder leading to the upper deck. He also explained that on a certain day, that of his mother's dream, a storm nearly wrecked their boat and hopelessly soaked his bed, and the account ends with the words, "I had nowhere to sleep." It is quite clear that in both these cases the dreamers, drawn by thoughts of love or anxiety, had really travelled in the astral body during sleep to those in whose fate they were so keenly interested, and simply witnessed the various occurrences as they took place. The confused dream, this, which is by far the commonest of all, may be caused, as has already been pointed out, in various ways. It may be simply a more or less perfect recollection of a series of the disconnected pictures and impossible transformations produced by the senseless automatic action of the lower physical brain. It may be a reproduction of the stream of casual thought which has been pouring through the etheric part of the brain. If sensual images of any kind enter into it, it is due to the ever-restless tide of earthly desire, probably stimulated by some unholy influence of the astral world. It may be due to an imperfect attempt at dramatization on the part of an undeveloped ego, or it may be, and most often is, due to an inextricable mingling of several or all of these influences. The way in which such mingling takes place will perhaps be made clearer by a short account of some of the experiments on the dream state recently made by the London Lodge of the Theosophical Society, with the aid of some clairvoyant investigators among its members. Chapter 6, Experiments on the Dream State. The objects specially in view in the investigation, part of which I am about to describe, was to discover whether it was possible to impress the ego of an ordinary person during sleep sufficiently to enable him to recollect the circumstance when he awoke, and it was also desired, as far as possible, to find out what are the obstacles that usually stand in the way of such recollection. The first experiment tried was with an average man of small education and rough exterior, a man of the Australian shepherd type, whose astral form, as seen floating above his body, was externally little more than a shapeless wreath of mist. It was found that the consciousness of the body on the bed was dull and heavy, both as regards the grosser and the etheric parts of the frame. The former responded to some extent to external stimuli. For example, the sprinkling of two or three drops of water on the face called up in the brain, though somewhat tardily, a picture of a heavy shower of rain, while the etheric part of the brain was as usual a passive channel for an endless stream of disconnected thoughts, It rarely responded to any of the vibrations they produced, and even when it did, it seemed somewhat sluggish in its action. The ego floating above was in an undeveloped and semi-unconscious condition, but the astral envelope, though shapeless and ill-defined, showed considerable activity. The floating astral can at any time be acted upon, with an ease that can scarcely be imagined, by the conscious thought of another person, and in this case the experiment was made withdrawing it to some little distance from the physical body on the bed, with the result, however, that as soon as it was more than a few yards away, considerable uneasiness was manifested in both the vehicles, and it became necessary to desist from the attempt, as evidently any further withdrawal would have caused the man to awake, probably in a state of great terror. A certain scene was chosen, a view of the most magnificent character from the summit of a mountain in the tropics, and a vivid picture of it was projected by the operator into the dreamy consciousness of the ego, which assimilated and examined it, though in a dull, apathetic, and unappreciative kind of way. Some time the man was awakened, the object being, of course, to see whether he recollected it as a dream. His mind, however, was an absolute blank on the subject, and except for some vague yearnings of the most animal description, he had brought back no memory whatever from the state of sleep. It was suggested that possibly the constant stream of thought forms from outside, which flowed through his brain, might constitute an obstacle by so distracting it as to make it unreceptive to influences from its higher principles. So after the man had again fallen asleep, a magnetic shell was formed around his body to prevent the entrance of this stream, and the experiment was tried again. When thus deprived of its ordinary pabulum, his brain began very slowly and dreamily to evolve out of itself scenes of the man's past life, but when he was again aroused, the result was precisely the same. His memory was absolutely blank as to the scene put before him, though he had some vague idea of having dreamed of some event in his past. This subject was then for the time resigned as hopeless, it being fairly evident that his ego was too little developed, and his karmic principle too strong, to give any reasonable probability of success. Another effort made with the same man at a later period was not quite so utter a failure, the scene put before him in this case being a very exciting incident from the battlefield, which was chosen as being probably more likely to appeal to his type of mind than the landscape. This picture was undoubtedly received by this undeveloped ego with more interest than the other, but still, when the man was awakened, the memory was gone, all that remained being an indistinct idea that he had been fighting, but where or why he had quite forgotten. The next subject taken was a person of much higher type, a man of good moral life, educated and intellectual, with broad philanthropic ideas and exalted ambitions. In his case, the denser body responded instantaneously to the water test by a very respectable picture of a tremendous thunderstorm, and that in turn, reacting on the etheric part of the brain, called up by association a whole series of vividly represented scenes. When this disturbance was over, the usual stream of thoughts began to flow through, but it was observable that a far greater proportion of them awoke a response in this brain. Also that the responsive vibrations were much stronger, and that in each case a train of associations was started which sometimes excluded the stream from outside for quite a considerable time. The astral vehicle in this subject was far more definite in its ovoid outline, and the body of denser astral matter within it was a very fair reproduction of his physical form, and while desire was decidedly less active, the ego itself possessed a much higher grade of consciousness. The astral body in this case could be drawn away to a distance of several miles from the physical without apparently producing the slightest sense of disquiet in either of them. When the tropical landscape was submitted to this ego, he at once seized upon it with the greatest appreciation, admiring and dwelling upon its beauties in the most enthusiastic manner. After letting him admire it for a while, the man was aroused, but the result was somewhat disappointing. He knew that he had had a beautiful dream, but was quite unable to recall any details, the few elusive fragments that were uppermost in his mind being remnants of the ramblings of his own brain. With him, as with the other man, the experiment was then repeated with the addition of a magnetic shell thrown round the body, and in this case, As in the other, the brain at once began to evolve pictures of its own. The ego received the landscape with even greater enthusiasm than at first, recognizing it at once as the view he had seen before, and surveying it point by point with quite ecstatic admiration of its many beauties. But while he was thus engaged in contemplation of it, the etheric brain down below was amusing itself by recalling pictures of his school life, the most prominent being a scene on a winter day, when the ground was covered with snow, and he and a number of his playmates were snowballing one another in the school playground. When the man was aroused as usual, the effect was exceedingly curious. He had a most vivid remembrance of standing upon the summit of a mountain, admiring a magnificent view, and he even had the main features of the scenery quite clearly in his mind, but instead of the gorgeous tropical verdure which lent such richness to the real prospect, he saw the surrounding country entirely covered with a mantle of snow. And it seemed to him that even while he was drinking in with deep delight the loveliness of the panorama spread out before him, he suddenly found himself, by one of the rapid transitions so frequent in dreams, snowballing with boyhood's long-forgotten companions in the old schoolyard, of which he had not thought for years. Chapter 7. Conclusion. Surely these experiments show very clearly how the remembrance of our dreams becomes so chaotic and inconsequent as it frequently is. Incidentally, they also explain why some people, in whom the ego is undeveloped and earthly desires of various kinds are strong, never dream at all, and why many others are only now and then, under a collocation of favorable circumstances, able to bring back a confused memory of nocturnal adventure. And we see, further, from them that if a man wishes to reap in his waking consciousness the benefit of what his ego may learn during sleep, it is absolutely necessary for him to acquire control over his thoughts, to subdue all lower passions, and to attune his mind to higher things. If he will take the trouble to form during waking life the habit of sustained and concentrated thought, he will soon find that the advantage lie gains thereby is not limited to the daytime in its action. Let him learn to hold his mind in check, to show that he is master of that also, as well as of his lower passions. Let him patiently labor to acquire absolute control of his thoughts, so that he will always know exactly what he is thinking about, and why, and he will find that his brain, thus trained to listen only to the promptings of the ego, will remain quiescent when not in use, and will decline to receive and respond to casual currents from the surrounding ocean of thought, so that he will no longer be impervious to influences from the less material planes, where insight is keener and judgment truer than they can ever be down here. The performance of a very elementary act of magic may be of assistance to some people in this training of the etheric part of the brain. The pictures which it evolves for itself, when the thought stream from outside is shut off, are certainly less likely altogether to prevent the recollection of the ego's experiences, than is the tumultuous rush of that thought stream itself. So the exclusion of this turbid current, which contains so much more evil than good, is of itself no inconsiderable step towards the desired end. And that much may be accomplished without serious difficulty. Let a man when he lies down to sleep think of the aura which surrounds him, let him will strongly that the outer surface of that aura shall become a shell to protect him from the impingement of influences from without, and the auric matter will obey his thought, a shell will really be formed around him, and the thought stream will be excluded. Warning students wishing for some reason to guard their physical bodies during sleep may be warned not to repeat the mistake made some time ago by a worthy friend who took a great deal of trouble to surround himself with a specially impenetrable shell on a certain occasion, but made it of astral instead of etheric matter, and consequently took it away with him when he left his physical body. Naturally, the result was that his physical body was left entirely unprotected, while he himself floated about all night enclosed in triple armor, absolutely incapable of sending out a single vibration to help anybody, or of being helped or beneficially influenced by any loving thoughts which may have been directed towards him by teachers or friends. C. W. Leadbeater. The Hidden Side of Things. Another point very strongly brought out in our further investigations is the immense importance of the last thought in a man's mind as he sinks to sleep. This is a consideration which never occurs to the vast majority of people at all, yet it affects them physically, mentally, and morally. We have seen how passive and how easily influenced man is during sleep. If he enters that state with his thought fixed upon high and holy things, he thereby draws round him the elementals created by like thought in others. His rest is peaceful, his mind open to impressions from above and closed to those from below, for he has set it working in the right direction. If, on the contrary, he falls asleep with impure and earthly thoughts floating through his brain, he attracts to himself all the gross and evil creatures who come near him, while his sleep is troubled by the wild surgings of passion and desire which render him blind to the sights, deaf to the sounds, that come from higher planes. All earnest theosophists should therefore make a special point of raising their thoughts to the loftiest level of which they are capable before allowing themselves to sink into slumber. For remember, through what seem at first but the portals of dream, entrance may perchance presently be gained into those grander realms where alone true vision is possible. If one guides his soul persistently upward, its inner senses will at last begin to unfold, the light within the shrine will burn brighter and brighter, until at last the full continuous consciousness comes, and then he will dream no more. To lie down to sleep will no longer mean for him to sink into oblivion, but simply to step forth radiant, rejoicing, strong, into that fuller, nobler life where fatigue can never come, where the soul is always learning, even though all his time be spent in service, for the service is that of the great masters of wisdom, and the glorious task they set before him is to help ever to the fullest limit of his power in their never-ceasing work for the aiding and the guidance of the evolution of humanity.